The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. It's a Monday morning. We're in the studio. And Jackie, I heard the ski slopes were amazing over the weekend.
Yeah, there was like 10 centimeters of snow each day. And it was great. The problem is everyone in Calgary heard about it and a lot of people made it. I was at Sunshine Village. It was crazy the amount of people that came out there. It was like a peak day in Christmas holidays.
I heard it was lined up to the highway in terms of the cars trying to get in.
Yeah, and then the lineups on the lifts. Now, they are one single line and you're spaced out, so it looks maybe bigger than it is, but pretty huge lineups to get up on the lifts as well.
Everybody's trying to get to the slopes before there's a full lockdown. The numbers are up on the coronavirus, so I'm sort of expecting any day now we're going to be back to where we were back in April, but we shall see.
Yeah, we'll just see. And I think that's probably why so many people came out. I mean, for November to have that many people out in the mountains is pretty unusual.
It sure is. Well, we've got a lot to talk about. No guests today, but we've got a lot to talk about. We want to talk a little bit about Canadian net zero legislation, some stuff on energy efficiency, oil and gas, you name it. I don't know.
Let's just cover the topics.
Yeah, let's go.
So last week, Canada's federal government tabled new legislation that would force current and future governments to set binding targets around climate and to get to net zero by 2050. So the idea is they would have five-year targets all the way to 2050. So to me, you know, this made some news, but I didn't see it as a surprise. The Liberals have had it in their platform.
No, it was in the election platform, and Environment Minister Wilkinson has been talking about getting the initiative going. So it's going to happen.
The support from the industry is there. For example, we've talked about it before. A third of all Canadian oil production has net zero targets. Mm-hmm. So Husky and Cenovus now together, CNRL and MEG. And on top of that, the day of the tabling of this new legislation, the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers, so CAP, came out with a supportive statement saying that they are committed to working with the Canadian government to meet their emission reduction objectives, which includes the ambition to achieve net zero by 2050. They go on to say, by working together, we can further accelerate innovation, develop technology that reduces emissions while delivering responsibly produced energy. I think some people think the industry isn't supportive. This is a pretty supportive statement from the Canadian biggest industry association in Canada.
Yeah, I think it's important to note that the oil and gas industry has been under environmental pressures for well over a decade. The notion of net zero has been talked about now for a couple of years. The companies you mentioned have stepped up over the last eight, certainly well before the pandemic, and said they were going to go for net zero. I think that this legislation is more interesting when we think about the broader economy, because there's a lot of industries that are going to have to work hard to achieve these sorts of targets. But I feel like because of the pressures that the oil and gas industry has been under, they're actually well prepared to meet the challenge.
The milestone of this announcement and the support by CAP is really constructive. You know, the debate is behind us, hopefully now. Now is the time to constructively work together on the policy frameworks that would create the environment for these reductions. Like, the reality is today, I don't see it happening because we don't have a high enough carbon price or the right policies to support CCS and some of these technologies. And hopefully now we can work constructively together on those policy solutions that should move in that direction of net zero.
Yeah, and I think we have to, because the new administration, the Biden administration coming in the U.S., has stated that this is going to be a priority. There are many states, independent of the federal government down in the United States, that have indicated that they're pursuing this type of initiative. Certainly municipalities all across North America and in Europe are pursuing it. So we have a chance here. We have a chance here to lead the way. And I should qualify that and say, it's not going to be easy, but I think the wheels are in motion to get us in the right direction.
Let's switch to your recent Energy File post, which we will put a link to in the show notes. It's on the topic of energy efficiency. And you talk about these tools that people used to use to limit the amount of candle wax they would use each night.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's a great little object that I picked up in Sweden, five, 6 years ago. It's an automatic candle snuffer from the 1700s. And what it happens is you clamp the device on your candle where you want it to stop burning as the candle burns down. And as soon as it reaches that point, this little mechanical device comes and snaps down and snuffs out the candle. So effectively, it's like your smart home device that turns the lights off at a prescribed time.
It's so you have a certain budget of light that night.
Exactly.
When it's done, it's done.
Well, you know, wax was expensive, whether it came from tallow or beeswax or others. And quite often it was actually taxed in some of the European countries. Anyway, the point is that the energy efficiency and being smart about energy use is nothing new. And it's really important further to our previous conversation, because a third of all emissions reductions going forward to 2050 are expected to come from energy efficiency, including smart home devices and those sorts of things.
Yeah, it's a really important point. When you look at these projections of getting to this less than 2-degree world, you know, we go from a situation where energy use kept growing. We've been growing at about 2% every year in terms of the amount of energy humans consume on the Earth. So we keep every year growing 2%. And those projections just show it flattening off. So we don't have any growth anymore, despite the fact that population's still growing, people are still getting more wealthy. So all of that flattening of the curve, that curve has to come from energy efficiency.
It does.
We haven't shown that we're very good at it in the past.
No, it's every time we introduce energy efficiency devices, what typically happens is that people just end up using more energy, because the energy efficiency actually is a way of releasing capacity and supply. And that has a tendency to bring down prices. And so therefore people use more. The unfortunate thing about clean and green energy is it seems to me that it's giving the broad population a sense that there is an unlimited amount of energy for very low cost that is effectively also environmentally cost-free. And that's just not true. I mean, there's a cost to every sorts of energy, whether it comes from renewables or otherwise. And so on the consuming end, when we see things like electric Hummers, which I think they sold out in, it just was announced recently, and the first year of production was sold out in 10 minutes, you know, to move that giant vehicle around requires a lot of electricity, wherever it comes from.
And a lot of batteries.
And a lot of batteries, which requires a lot of mining and a lot of other sorts of environmental issues and effects. So energy efficiency is technologically driven, whether it's by that device that I show in my energy file collection, or whether it's a modern smart home, or whether it's devices in your vehicle to increase fuel economy. But if all you do is take the gains and buy more energy with it, that's not really accomplishing very much.
Yeah. Well, and you know, as you know, everyone's decorating for Christmas early this
year.
I'll admit I decorated yesterday, but the lights that people are putting on their houses are quite nice when you walk around at night.
They're beautiful.
But we put out way more
because
they're so efficient today.
I like to say that, you know, it's a modern LED light bulb is 6 times more efficient than the average incandescent light bbulb. Yet if you put up 7 times as many lights, you offset the gains you make from energy efficiency. So all the way back to the notion that we're going to flatten out total energy demand, personally, if it's not properly communicated and the policies are not properly administered in terms of energy efficiency, then history would tell us that people tend to abuse energy efficiency, actually.
Now, one area that I find kind of interesting is the school curriculum. That's an area where we're taught to recognize about how we need to conserve energy. And I actually remember this because I'm an energy nerd. I remember very little from the grade 4 curriculum, but I do remember that they had the whole chapter on energy efficiency, turning off the lights, conserving energy. And I took that home and gave my parents quite a few lectures around our energy use. And in fact, we had to invent something. And I remember this quite clearly. I invented a feather that you could, you know, go around your house, you know, around those electrical plug-ins on the outside walls and determine if you were getting a draft in, and then go tell your dad that he had to go fix those drafty spots or around the windows, right? So that was my project. And my daughter actually is in grade 4 and recently had her elementary project, and it was kind of a whole other level from what I had invented. We're going to cut to that where she's going to explain her energy efficiency project.
Then plug a butt sensor when your phone is done fully charging and plug your phone from the charger. It also is connected by Bluetooth to your phone, and if it senses when a light is on, it sends a notification to ask you to turn off the light.
Wow, that's amazing. I certainly wasn't doing that. My definition of energy efficiency or energy project in grade 4 was running for the nuclear bomb drill.
You didn't remember having any concerns about energy efficiency.
No, it was the Cold War, and we were worried about a different kind of energy, nuclear energy, not in a good way.
Well, the thing about her project, first of all, like kids are, I guess they're exposed to so much technology. I certainly wouldn't have invented something like that at that age. But maybe that's the solution, like these digital tools that control things for us, because mm-hmm. we're not very good at doing it.
No,
so,
we're not.
You know, maybe with digital technology, there's a better chance of flattening
that. Well, I think
there
is. There's no question that digital smart home technologies are going to help a lot, not only in the home, but in factories, in our vehicles, and so on.
Yeah. I mean, we don't always think of these things, but hopefully these tools will, and they will proactively help to flatten the energy use. Okay. I want to talk about an announcement from Shell. So if you remember, we had Duncan Van Bergen, ahead of Shell Climate-Based Solutions, on our podcast. Yeah, mm-hmm. that was the end of September. Mm-hmm. And he talked about Shell giving drivers the option of offsetting the greenhouse gas emissions associated with the tank of gas that they buy when they come to fill up at the tank, and that was being offered in many places around the world, but they announced November 14th, they're now going to offer it in Canada.
Wow.
Yeah, so I was pretty excited. So I tweeted, I plan to offset the GHG from filling my car by paying 2 cents per liter. Most people will not get an EV soon, but we can still drive carbon neutral. So I had some people that took issues with that tweet. So I thought we'd talk about the two issues. The first issue was some people doubted that this was legit and that Shell cannot offset emissions for 2 cents. In fact, someone called it chicken feed and PR from Shell.
Yeah, well, I think the trust issue is a big one. I mean, so there's two issues with the trust. One is, can Shell really do it with the 2 cents, which is what you just highlighted? And the other one is, what's Shell going to do with the money? I don't trust them at all, which is even a more cynical view of the world. And I think that is going to probably be a leading contributor to whether or not people will pay the 2 cents. I think it's a noble exercise. The jury is out as to how much they are actually going to be able to get adoption of this program. I think it's going to actually be a really good test. It's almost like a real-time poll as to how much people are willing to pay to offset carbon. And so I don't know if they're going to release their results as a consequence of this. But it's going to be really interesting to see.
Well, and I think these are third-party verified credits. So I have no doubt that they're doing it and that's the price. The reality is nature is the cheapest way to offset emissions.
Well, it is.
So I think those are legit. I trust Shell in that way.
I think the program is very legit. I think it's certified. It's just public perception. I mean, we're just in this era of tremendous distrust, tremendous polarization, tremendous cynicism. So I think getting people to pay 2 cents for something that isn't by and large actually quite complicated behind the scenes and nebulous and very politically charged is going to be difficult. But, you know, let's see what happens.
I did want to point out, too, there are other real benefits here. Like, they're collaborating with First Nations to plant 840,000 trees. They're sourcing carbon credits from a project that's conserving inland rainforest in BC. So not only do you get the GHG benefits, there's benefits to some of the local communities and economic development and conservation.
I'll just, for the purpose of being skeptical, I'll be skeptical. It's just when you pull up to the pump and you're daydreaming and you put the nozzle in the tank, I don't think you're thinking about that stuff. Thinking about, okay, how cheap can I get my gas and how quickly can I get home as you look at your watch?
Yeah, so, we'll see. Well, you know what? I do plan to fill up on Shell, although I do have to go out of my way now to do that. So hopefully I'll stick with it because it's not the most convenient for me. Okay, the second issue is a bigger issue. Some people debated my EV comment, and I agree, I made a mistake there. I said, people will not get an EV soon, but we can still drive carbon neutral. And the complaint was, driving an EV does not mean you're carbon neutral if you're in Alberta, where our power grid is not zero emission. So they're totally right. And we've looked at this in the past. In fact, I did these calculations myself, because what I found when you look at these studies is they have all different results. Some say, you know, driving an EV is worse, some say it's better. And I wanted to do the calculations myself to just better understand what's driving it. And first of all, I'll say is, you have to be comparing apples to apples. So sometimes they're comparing a combustion engine that's a large car to a Leaf, a tiny car, right? And so that's not comparable. And then what oil are you using? If you use the highest carbon intensity oil, you get different results than the lowest carbon intensity oil. And then, of course, what electricity are you comparing to? And even within the world of coal, there's a big difference. Like, the most efficient coal plants have lower GHG than some of the older ones, right? So this is why people get different answers, right?
There's so many answers, so many variables to this question. But I wouldn't say you're totally wrong, because there's always shades of green here. there is a crossover point, and I remember doing the calculation about it, I don't know, probably about 10 years ago, you know, at what coal mix does the average EV substituting for the average vehicle become less carbon intense than a gasoline vehicle? Okay, I'm sure you followed that. Do you know what I mean? Like, what is the cross?
Yeah, like, what's the point where...
I think the coal mix crossover is when coal becomes less than about, 60% of the Alberta energy grid. Then, you know, it's 50-60, we'll call it 50-60%. It gets below that. Then an EV is actually less carbon intense from end to end than the average combustion vehicle. I think we're almost there. I haven't looked at the latest coal mix in Alberta, but I think it's less, certainly less than 60%, I think.
Peter, I looked this up ahead of the show, but the most recent data I could find was 2018, and it showed that we're 49% natural gas and 43% coal. So we're there. And we independently did our calculations here, but, you know, when I looked at all those variables, and by the way, I didn't count the energy for making the vehicle. So that's the other thing. Some of these studies include that, and they look at the energy for the batteries. We didn't do that. But if I looked at that and I tried to have a comparable car, then I said an EV with coal power is about the same as a combustion engine. You're not really, so if you're 100% coal power, you're about the same. If you were with natural gas power, it's about half. So I come to the same conclusion. If you get into that 60% range, you're ahead. But you still do have some emissions, to be fair. Is that a reason to hold up buying an EV, though? I don't think so, because as we've talked about on the podcast before, the installed vehicle fleet in the world is huge. Is it like a billion vehicles? And we can only produce so many new EVs every year. And today, only about 4% of new cars this year are going to be EVs. So you have to start getting the EVs into the system now, because over the next 15 years, I think our grid will get cleaner. I mean, we're making all these commitments to net zero, but you can't just change the cars after that. You change them now, and over time, those cars become more clean because the electricity is going to get more clean. You know, we're moving the problem from a distributed emissions at every tailpipe to emissions at the central power station, which is going to be a lot easier to deal with.
Yeah. Well, call me the skeptic again. You know, I'll say that people will not buy an EV because they're doing these calculations in their head, which is greener, which is cleaner. People like me buy an EV because it's a thrill to drive. The acceleration, the smoothness, and the overall utility now is compelling, in my opinion, certainly for city commuting. And that's why I drive it. The added bonus on top of that is all the things that we've talked about. And that's where you want to be, is where the, you know, the overall utility of a product is better than what you had before, and it's at a lower price. Now, that latter point, at a lower price, we're not quite there yet with EVs, but we're getting closer. And as soon as an EV becomes cheaper than an internal combustion engine vehicle, then the overall utility of it becomes unequivocally compelling. And I think this is what people are saying, is that we are going to reach that point probably in the next 5 years, certainly no more than 10. And at that point is when you can expect the adoption rates to really go up higher.
Yeah. And I think the other big thing is there's a real lack of choice right now. Like, if I wanted to go buy an EV in Canada, if I wanted a little bit larger vehicle, there's very little out there, right? So there's a number of models coming out in the next several years.
There's a lot of models, including the electric Hummer. If you choose to buy that, and the big Tesla pickup truck, the F-150, GM just got into the game. So, you know, in the next 5 years, you're going to have a lot of choice. And just also point out that on the Tesla battery day, I mean, now they're talking about electric vehicles that have 1,000-kilometer range, potentially.
In the future.
In the future, like an average
sedan. That would be a big changer. Like,
and even today, you know, you can get 400-500K under reasonable driving conditions, and that's still huge. The range anxiety issue, in my opinion, is no longer an issue unless you're hauling some big load like an RV or something like that.
Yeah, and I think there's more charging stations all the time, and that's going to get better, actually, especially with some of this stimulus spending that's going to probably focus on that. Okay, so let's switch topics now. We haven't talked about the oil markets in quite a long time,
I
know a lot of our listeners follow them day to day. So let's talk about what's going on. I thought we would talk about the latest headlines in the oil markets. So big problems in that there's just more supply than we anticipated, a big part because of Libya. So there was a civil war going on in that country for many years. And there was a ceasefire that was agreed to. And they really surprised the world oil markets. You know, they were producing at about 100,000 barrels a day. And now they're over 1 million barrels a day. That's what's being reported. And so that's just additional supply coming into a already oversupplied market. Mm-hmm. So that's a negative headline.
So where are we at on the demand side? Today, it's bounced back to around 95 because actually China and some of the Asian economies are actually doing quite well. Notwithstanding the pandemic, they've recovered far faster. And so we're at 95.
We've been that way since September. And the view is that we've kind of plateaued. Like until people start getting back into airplanes, we're going to see a permanent decrease in the amount of jet fuel. And then there's a decrease in the amount of other products that just isn't going to come back until people get back to their old lifestyles. And the original view, if you go back several months, is that by the end of this year, we'd only be down about 3% or 3 million barrels a day instead of 5. The other thing that's changed is the view is probably we stay with this impairment of around 5 million barrels a day till the middle of next year now, because there's no reason to think that that demand comes back until we get this vaccine.
Right.
Now, the really positive headline was the news around the vaccine. The last three Mondays, including today, had news about these vaccines looking good and that it is possible potentially that in the second half of 2021, we would have a lot of people in the world vaccinated and could get some of this demand back.
Yeah, I think you'll see that, although the logistical challenges in getting the vaccine out to enough people to start really making a difference. But I do think that by next summer, you're going to start to see a better tone. And even, I mean, without the vaccine, if you looked at the Transportation Safety Administration, the TSA statistics for people flying in the U.S., I mean, it was steadily creeping up. Now, I imagine it's sort of plateaued now with the third wave in the United States, which is a really big one.
Yeah, we actually keep that on our weekly energy charts if anyone wants to look at that.
Yeah,
there's a lot of noise associated with it, but it has sort of been plateauing. The other thing is maybe this 5 million barrels a day is too optimistic. As we all know, we're starting to see lockdowns in major jurisdictions. For example, in Europe, which is a 15 million barrel a day demand center, it's a major center for oil demand. They're starting to have lockdowns. And I looked last night at the Paris data from that TomTom traffic. Mm-hmm. And it showed that the traffic had recovered to near normal from September to October, but now it's down by half. So we're starting to see that activity slowing, and we may see that here in North America.
But I do think that this is a short-term thing. I mean, already the numbers in Europe are starting to roll over. They're talking about limited Christmas family gatherings. And I think by spring, you're going to see a very different type of situation. I don't think we're going to see, for example, wholesale business travel rebounding anytime soon. But I do think there's a lot of pent-up desire for mobility in people, especially if we're going to be locked down yet again here over the course of the next few months as the numbers get worse. Are we going to get back to the 100 million barrels per day by next year? I don't think so. But at the same time, I think you're going to start to see more robust numbers. Let's get back to that. The Libyan million barrels a day that's come on to the market are likely to be absorbed. We've seen the United States production fall by 2 million barrels per day. Canada's fallen by what?
Well, it's hard to know because we don't have all that oil sands supply back on, but I think the expectation is there will be some impairment to the production over what we would have thought it would have been without COVID.
And the OPEC countries look like they're holding in terms of their compliance, the OPEC plus countries, right?
Well, you know, that is the big question, right? We definitely need OPEC plus to continue to cut their production. And the big question in front of them is when they put out their plan back in May about what they wanted to do, they had envisioned that they would see a 2 million barrel a day increase in January of 2021. So there's been news over the last few weeks about, are they going to do that? Are they not going to do that? Are people supportive? They definitely need to do that, especially with demand flattening to maybe even declining a little. And at the same time, this extra supply from Libya. So we'll just be watching the news over the next few weeks to see that they do continue with their cuts and even extend them, you know, so that they don't see that increase.
Well, I think they're going to have to into 2021 for sure. But, you know, just for our audience, a reminder, we've talked about this before, it doesn't take much of a surplus or a deficit, like a million barrels per day, you know, under normal circumstances, about 1%. So plus or minus 1% on either side can swing the price of oil by $5 or $10 often.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you got to remember too, like, OPEC is still sitting, OPEC Plus, on 8 million barrels a day of spare capacity. Yeah. So that's like 8 million barrels a day that they've got the valves turned off. That's a huge, in the history of the oil markets, there's very few periods where we've had that type of spare capacity.
But what do you say to people who say, look, the price of oil has been so low, the cash flow is almost de minimis for many of the companies, state-owned or otherwise. Drilling is at, I don't know, multi-decade low, not only in North America, but even around the world. And so there's going to be a supply side response. In other words, supply is actually already responding to expectations of lower demand. And it's not a 2021 story, but it's a 2022, 2023 story that by 2022, vaccine is well established, people are getting immunized, mobility is really coming back, and we haven't drilled enough to be able to supply the oil that's needed.
I think there's definitely a thesis that the market will tighten. Mm-hmm. The lack of investment would support that. But the next year or two look pretty challenged because you're sitting with very high inventory levels, a lot of OPEC spare capacity. So you don't need new investment, right? You just need demand to increase and OPEC to open up the valves. So it's a few years off before that market tightens up because we just have a big glut.
I'm sort of looking at the market, though. Look, you've got the 8 million that you talk about of spare capacity. You've got Libya coming on. But
we haven't talked about Iran, by the way.
And Iran. Yeah. But look, we've got the price of oil has gone from $39, $40 to, I think it's, I'm talking about WTI, $42, $43. I mean, that's a pretty big move.
Well, a lot of that was on the hope of the vaccine because the vaccine is such a big deal, right? If that comes sooner and demand comes back, if we get that extra 5 million barrels a day, then suddenly OPEC doesn't have a ton of spare capacity.
I would just say that the market sentiment is definitely biased to the upside. Like it wants to go higher and there's expectations that things are going to get better. And it, you know, the oil markets are fully aware of Libya, fully aware of the potential of Iran. They factor in the uncertainties relating to the vaccines and et cetera, et cetera. And it looks like it wants to go higher.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. We'll see. I think it's a ways off, but, I do hope it stays at this $40 level because without it, we're going to see what we saw in May and April, you know, where we saw shut-ins and companies losing money every day and completely unsustainable, right? So I think it probably will stay in this low 40s, which we won't get supply growth, but we also will have companies that can pay their bills and at least sort of tread water.
Well, I think, you know, the market is always based on expectations priced in to today. And I think that by the time we get to the middle of next year, looking into 2022 as an expectation, that you're going to see the price of oil percolate back potentially into that $50, $60 range because of all these factors that, that we talked about. But hey, that's where we were pre-pandemic, right? And pre-pandemic, we didn't have the lowest rig count ever and a curtailment in drilling. We didn't have the Permian in the U.S. and Canadian markets completely shut off from capital markets. In other words, to be able to raise money to drill. And so I think that there's a very interesting dynamic that's being set up. I certainly hear all the negative sentiments, but I tend to lean more to the view that the market has a set of expectations that are more bullish than bearish.
So let's leave it at that. I think we've extended our time here. So thank you very much, everyone, for joining our podcast. If you like this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.